This podcast is brought to you by ProXPN.com. Get your guard up and reclaim your internet security and privacy with a free ProXPN account. Don't delay. Go to ProXPN.com and get your free VPN account today. Thanks, ProXPN.com.
This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harrell.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I'm Jim Harrell. So glad to be with you once again. We have a couple of erudite UFO investigators and authors that we've had with us before, and we always enjoy talking to them. They always have a fascinating perspective and some great case histories to talk to us about. I'm talking about Noe Torres and Ruben Uriarte, and we're going to talk about their book, Aliens in the Forest, The Cisco Grove UFO Encounter. And Noe and Ruben are active members of the UFO research community. If you've followed it anytime, you've heard their names. And they've had many years of experience investigating UFOs in the southwestern U.S. and northern Mexico. Their research has appeared on the History Channel's UFO Hunters and UFO Files television shows. Their first book, Mexico's Roswell, the Chihuahua UFO Crash, received wide critical acclaim and was the basis for a February 2008 episode of UFO Hunters, in which the authors appeared. They've also appeared frequently on many other UFO-related TV and radio shows and have spoken at many UFOs conferences and events and have been on my shows. I know they've been on things like Coast to Coast, big things like that. Just two great guys, two very knowledgeable people, and we can't wait to once again mine their wisdom.
Well, thank you very much, Jim. Ruben and I are just thrilled to death to be on your show again, because we have some very exciting stuff that's been happening that Ruben and I have been working on. We've got new witnesses in some of our cases. We've got a big UFO festival coming up in West Texas in October. And we've got all kinds of interesting things that we can talk about today. And, of course, we're going to primarily be focusing, of course, on our recent book, Aliens in the Forest.
Well, yes, Aliens in the Forest. Now, tell us, for those of us who are uninitiated and not familiar, Noe and Ruben, tell us about the Cisco Grove UFO encounter. What was it and when did it happen?
Well, in a nutshell, and I'm going to let Ruben chime in as well, but to get the story started, on Friday, September 4th, 1964... that was, you know, a lot of interesting stuff was going on historically in the United States at that time. It was the beginning of manned space flight. It was the Cold War was still going on. President Kennedy had just been assassinated. We were getting up to our eyebrows in the Vietnam conflict, soon to become the Vietnam War. And right there in 1964, these three gentlemen went hunting in the Tahoe National Forest in northeastern California, near the town of Cisco Grove, California. And these three gentlemen went out for a weekend hunting excursion when they became separated during the course of the evening, and one of them, Mr. Shrum, Donald Shrum, who we're going to talk about tonight, had an incredible UFO encounter where he saw a huge 150-foot-long mothership descend and hover near him, and then he saw some strange beings that came toward him, and he found himself confronted and faced with the battle of his life, because he fought off these creatures all night long who were obviously trying to carry him away as either a specimen or a trophy. And he fought with them all night long, 12 hours, in an attempt to keep from being abducted. So it's a fascinating story.
So these folks, they were out hunting, minding their own business. The thing that I love about the cases that have a little bit of age on them is that in our current day and age, you have the YouTube phenomena. And everybody's chasing a ghost, and everybody's hunting a ghost, and everybody's looking for UFOs. But back then, you know, certainly there were reports, but it wasn't a thing to go out and have a UFO experience, was it?
It really wasn't, and Ruben can add more to this. Go ahead, Ruben.
Thank you, Noe. Yeah, Noe was saying, there are a lot of activity going on worldwide in terms of the politics, the political structure, the political issues that were going on throughout our world. But also, we were having a number of UFO sightings, specifically in Northern California. I was sharing with Noe about a case of a actual saucer landing with entities at the Air Force Base near McClellan Air Force Base, which turned out to be significant in the case that we were investigating aliens in the force. The way we came across this material is that about more than 10 years ago, I had acquired these files from the late Paul Cerny. Paul Cerny was a MUFON investigator. He was our Western Regional Director, and later, before MUFON, he was a investigator with NICAP. It was NICAP that was involved in the actual investigation of this case in 1965. But in those files, I came across what was referred back then as the bow and arrow case. And as I read through it, I said, oh my God, I can't believe how this one man had to deal with this encounter of these beings trying to survive. Well, and then I said, I hope to meet this man someday, and through some synchronicity, through some contacts, I had the opportunity of meeting Don and his family at his home. And with the assistance of his son, we were able to video record the entire investigation and the interviews. And so with that, and I was just very, very blessed to have connected with Noe at the time we were working on other book projects, and we were able to compile all the information, work with the family. It was the desire of the family that they wanted this to be into a book. And and Noe and I had been discussing this because we knew we were dealing with a timetable because of the health of the Shrumps. And his wife, Judy Shrum, had just passed away about a month or more ago from cancer. But her desire was that we have this story put into a book, which we were able to do. So with that, kind of give you just a view background, and Noe was able to put the interviews into these audio clips to share with your audience.
Well, I certainly want to go to the clips, and we're going to do so right after this on the Paranormal Podcast. This podcast is brought to you by ProXPN.com. Get your guard up and reclaim your internet security and privacy with a free ProXPN account. Don't delay. Go to ProXPN.com today and get your own free VPN account. Now, let me tell you a little bit of why this really is of interest to me. I make my livelihood on the internet, but unfortunately, internet freedom, internet privacy, internet security are mainly things of the past. For example, a lot of times I like to go to the local coffee house maybe to get a little work in, but still kind of interact with humanity. But I, up until ProXPN, I was afraid to use the Wi-Fi because the truth is, using easily accessible software, Joe Hacker could be sitting right next to you, look very friendly. He could be peering in and stealing all your passwords and your crucial information, and you'd never know it. You're there, la la la, sipping your latte and writing the great American novel, and you're being robbed. But it doesn't have to be that way. With ProXPN over at ProXPN.com, they have a VPN product that secures the Wi-Fi in public places, because after all, Wi-Fi is a radio signal that can be intercepted. And you can protect yourself by using the free account over at ProXPN.com. Not only is security concerned, but ISPs are being pressured by Big Brother to keep logs longer and longer. Big Brother knows what you're doing in every step, and I am a big believer in privacy. ProXPN at ProXPN.com. If you use them, your ISP can't track that online activity. A free version is available. That's the best news of all, and it works for almost all users. And if you're a power user and you want unlimited speed, bandwidth, server locations, and more, you can always sign up for their premium service, which also works on the iPhone, Android devices, and tablets. And again, the free version works for almost all people. So start off with that. Go over to proxpn.com. Do it today. Pause this podcast right now. Do us a favor to me, because it does help the show, but it also helps you by securing your internet connection. Proxpn.com. Check them out. I think that you will like what you see. Check them out. They're over at proxpn.com, and we thank them so much for their support. Proxpn.com.
Be sure to follow Jim on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+. Find all the links at jimherald.com. Now back to the Paranormal Podcast.
Welcome back to the Paranormal Podcast. Incredibly compelling subject tonight. We're talking about the Cisco Grove UFO encounter. We have actual testimony we're going to share with you momentarily. Our guests are Noe Torres and Ruben Uyarte. So Noe, can you set it up for us? I have 7 clips. Kind of take us through them, and we'll play them for the audience so they can hear it right from the proverbial horse's mouth, as it were.
Well, Ruben deserves all the credit for these recordings we're about to hear, because he did the actual interviewing, and I went through and I found the segments that help us through the story in kind of a timeline approach. And so really, the principal eyewitness in this case, Mr. Donald Shrum, is the person that you'll hear speaking in these clips. And in the first clip, he will be picking up the story from the time when he had become separated from the other hunters. And by the way, I should add that one of the other 3 hunters also gave a written affidavit afterward that he saw the initial sighting of the large ship that came down out of the Earth's atmosphere. So he later testified that he had seen that as well, although the most direct contact with the vessel and its occupants was by Mr. Shrum, whom we are about to hear. So in the first clip, he's going to talk about how he was looking for a place of safety to hole up for the night, because he had gotten separated from his 2 companions. And when all of a sudden he notices a light in the sky off in the distance. So that's in the first clip.
I saw a light. It looked like a lantern going up and down a trail. But then it came over the top of a tree, and I got kind of excited then because I thought it was a helicopter from the Forest Service. I stood between 2 of the fires that I built on the rock and waved my arms and yelled and screamed. And finally, that light started coming towards me. So I was really relieved then, because I thought it was a helicopter still, until it got within, maybe 60 feet or yards. I'm not sure the distance at night. But it just stood, hovered there with no sound. So then I panicked, because I knew it was no helicopter. I thought it was something from outer space. But it looked like all I could see is a little, about an 8-inch glow. So I thought it was just a little tiny, flying saucer. And then I kind of panicked, and I threw my bow up in the tree again and hand walked out there that limb and got up in the tree. I had all camouflage clothing on, so I figured, well, they won't see me here, but then this light went a half circle around me over the canyon. Then I could see the shadow of the whole spacecraft, and that was just a light that was on the nose of it.
Now that's some pretty compelling testimony from Don Shrum there. Can you talk about Mr. Shrum? What kind of person are we talking about here? Is he kind of salt of the earth? Is he into UFOs? What kind of person is he?
Don is definitely, as you described him, as the salt of the earth. It's a very low key, very humble person, but he has a lot of talent. One of the things that he has his unique hunting abilities, which he used all his wits that kept him alive throughout that night with the encounter that he had with the beings. Something else that I'm sure Noe, if you want to elaborate further, Noe, about his involvement with Aerojet design, with the Aerojet company, because
he was an employee of Aerojet Corporation, which in 1964 was one of the nation's leading missile defense contractors. And as his son, Dan Shrum, told us just a few nights ago when we were talking to him, Mr. Shrum held an important position with Aerojet, and it was one that required a high level of security. And that's really the main reason that Mr. Shrum refused to allow his name to be used when he reported this UFO incident initially. And throughout the rest of the 1960s and on into just in recent years, whenever people talked about this encounter, the Cisco Grove encounter, the witness's real name was never used. Now, a few years back, through his contact with Ruben and later myself, I became involved, and Mr. Shrum and his wife, Judy, decided that to break their silence and to tell the complete story for the first time ever and to start releasing the use of their name. So that tells you that he really didn't want, he wasn't a UFO believer. He was quite a bit of a skeptic before this happened. And then when it all played out in front of his very own eyes, and everybody in his family and his acquaintances all saw how deeply it had affected him, then, of course, at that point, he became a believer. But he didn't want the incident that he had undergone to affect his employment with Aerojet. That was something that he was very concerned about. And so that is the reason that he withheld his name. Now, he was the case was investigated by a number of very famous UFO investigators from the 60s. Ruben has already mentioned Paul Cerny, also Dr. Anita Brothers, Dr. James Harder, and J. Allen Hynek were also principal investigators in this case, and often, especially Dr. Hynek, considered this case to be in the same category as the Betty and Barney Hill encounter in New Hampshire of September 1961, which was just 3 years before the Shrum case, mm-hmm. as well as the Charles Hickson and Calvin Parker case in Pascagoula, Mississippi, which occurred in the early 70s, about 1973. And then, of course, there are also parallels to the fire in the sky incident, which happened in Arizona to Travis Walton. So there was a lot of information. There was a lot of interest in this case immediately following the its occurrence. But because the witness was employed with this missile defense contractor, then there was they were unable to release his name, his true identity, as per his request, and therefore, some people in the UFO investigation field considered this to be a weak case because of the fact that it was a quote-unquote anonymous witness. But in reality, there was a true and legitimate reason why the Shrums, who were really struggling financially at the time and could not afford to have Mr. Shrum be out of employment, there was a real reason why they did not want to become mired in the whole UFO thing at that period of time.
Well, as we go on here, we have a lot of other clips. I want to share some of them. This one talks about the scout ship arriving, and we'll play it and we'll let you both comment on it.
And then I saw three panels of light, like windows or whatever, and I saw a flash come from the bottom of the center one and just saw a dark object go down in the canyon, and then I lost track of it. Then the next thing I saw a little blinking light up on the top of originally where the first one came from. Well, at that time, all I saw was a flash and saw a dark object go down.
The dark object, what shape was it?
Well, I couldn't really say. It went so fast. But then I saw when it landed up on the ridge that I could see like a half, I could only see part of the top, but it had a little light on it. Looked like the top of a flying saucer. Really? That I'd seen in pictures.
Like a dome?
Yes. Yeah, like a dome.
This is interesting because the experience seems to have multiple stages. It's just not sighting one thing. It's multi-staged. It's a very elaborate sighting.
Oh, absolutely. When we get more into the actual case, he'll discuss his encounter with not only seeing the ship, but then the next phase with the actual entities that will come close to him. So it gets very, very interesting. And then it's the after effects. I mean, how this has affected Don, his family, the Air Force involvement, which unfortunately it turned out to be, they were trying to disillusion him, which you'll hear later in as we progress with the tapes.
Well, let's go to the next section and take a listen to that very compelling testimony from Mr. Shrum.
And I heard some thrashing through the brush, and probably 5-10 minutes, these two humanoids come out of the brush, and they kind of broke some of the brush off and was looking at it. And then they came straight underneath the tree and looked up at me. And I knew right then I was fingered.
They found you.
Yeah, they found me.
Can you describe them for us? Tell us briefly what they
were. Yeah, they were, looked like 4 to 5 feet. Of course, I'm looking down at them, so they'd be shorter than they probably are. And they had a silvery, like a one-piece suit on, and it seemed like it had the joints, puffy joints, you know, on the shoulders and the elbows and the legs. I didn't see that clear.
Were you able to see their faces?
No, it was just a kind of a dark shadow. I could see the two like eyes that looked like welding goggles to me. They were the same as welding goggles. They're about 2 inches in diameter. It reminded me just, like I said, like a welding goggles. And then the rest of the face was kind of a blur. I couldn't see looking down at them.
And what's interesting about this, again, I got to hit on this point again. These days, there are a lot of images in the popular media of what a, quote, alien looks like. But at this time, there have been a lot of saucer reports, but not as much as, you know, I mean, of course, George Adamski and some things. But many times they would say they were blonde-haired and blue-eyed. So the meme out there of what a quote, alien is supposed to look like really wasn't out in pop culture, was it?
No, we had the Betty and Barney Hill encounter, you know, where the beings had a distinctive appearance, the case being in 1961, but there wasn't a whole lot of, I mean, people weren't really focused in on the whole gray alien appearance, which has become commonplace, most notably in the late 60s, early 70s, but that really wasn't established yet. And however, either way you look at it, this is a very distinctive and unique entity that are set of, mm-hmm. two sets of entities that Mr. Shrum encountered.
I think the thing that most impressed me as Don was going through his testimony, the fact that I asked him what they look like, and he described them from the treetop level, that he was actually looking down. And that told me that, I said, you, that was an important part of the description, the fact that he was observing them from on top of the tree, and that he was able to see their faces, the eyes, but not the feet. And I thought, gee, that is very important detail right there. Normally when you talk to other witnesses, they may say things in general, but he was very specific.
Well, and if that wasn't frightening enough to him, now we start talking about robots. Let's take a listen.
Then I saw two flashing red-orange eyes just picking its way down the ridge, just between the rocks and around them and everything, and come down and was on this big boulder, this big flat rock. And then he kind of looked up at me, and he moved his hand through the fire cinders and kind of scattered them. Then he come down up on the rock. He was about 7 feet from me. And then he touched his mouth, and kind of a steam vapor come out of his mouth, and it lit up his face so I could see some detail. And then I blacked out when that steam hit me, kind of took the air from me. And I'd gasp for air and then black out. And I fell over my bow. And that's the only thing that kept me in the tree. And then, so I figured they were out to get me then.
The eyes of this other creature, like the robot, what did that look like to you?
And it had kind of like fire. It's kind of a orangish, reddish orange, or yellowish orange. It kind of flickered like fire. And they're about the same diameter as about 2 inches in diameter as the humanoids.
Did you hear any noise between them? Any communication? Was there any?
You know, I heard kind of a cooing or almost like an owl, but it could have been an owl, you know, that up there. But it just kind of fit in with them.
So he's in this situation, and it's kind of like, well, what do I do? What is the next step? How do I progress from that? We're going to take a lesson, a listen to something called Fighting Back. Fascinating.
I had a 60-pound bow, which is a very high velocity. Seeing how the robot's the only thing that was causing me harm, I shot the chest area, and it has the velocity of a rifle at that distance, because I'm only about 7-8 feet from him. And it when I hit the chest, the sparks would fly, like an arc welder, kind of. And then that robot backed up and almost knocked him down. He kind of fell back against a rock. And the two at the bottom took off and headed for the brush and stood out there about 30 feet from me. And then I shot two more arrows. And about the same time sequence, these two humanoids would, every time I'd shoot, they'd go back up into the brush, just almost out of sight from me. Then I ran out of arrows, so I only had three left. And I thought, well, that's when pomade hair is just, I mean, the cap I had on was just soaked with oil.
This is for your hair?
Yeah, from my hair, yeah, pomade. And I always carried all kinds of books of matches with me when I hunted. And so I lit that cap and it just blazed up, and I dropped it down the base of the tree. And just in that instant, they moved back about 12, 15 feet. And I glanced over at the ship that was over the canyon, kind of almost level with me. And it was almost out of sight. It was just like a star. It moved that fast just in that second. So then I got the idea that they're scared of fire. So I burned everything but my T-shirt and my jeans, and come to find out later on that it was 32 degrees out, and I was shaking and kind of overexposed for the weather. Oh, when I threw my canteen down, and they'd picked it up and looked at it and threw it back down. And I had a bunch of change, and I threw it down. And they all kind of gathered around it. Somebody told me on the coins that it gets dates, it gets pictures, you know. So there was, maybe that was the reason that they got most of the coins.
But you didn't find any?
No.
What about the robot creature?
After I started burning stuff and throwing it down, and I even tied some of my shirt that I ripped up to a compass so I could try to hit some brush, because there wasn't nothing right underneath the tree. And then I caught a little pile of brush on fire. I figured that would bring the cavalry. But when I run out of stuff to burn, I headed for the top of the tree. And then it was a pretty sparse tree. I could see down to the ground. And I broke off the top and threw it down. And anytime I throw down or shake the tree, these humanoids would back up. When I was up in the top of that tree, I thought about just jumping off and jumping down the canyon and just killing myself. But the only thing that kept me going is I had the little girl, my wife, and that kept me fighting.
So, I mean, this was no joke. He was really afraid for his life.
He was terribly afraid, yeah. Jim. And in fact, Ruben tells me that when he has interviewed Mr. Shrum, it becomes very visible to anyone looking at him that he's reliving this experience in his mind. Ruben, tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, I find it I was very fascinated by his body language when we were interviewing him, and I was, as he was reliving it, I could see his whole body, his eyes, as if he was right at the very moment that he was dealing with these entities. So definitely it has taken a big toll on him. And even though this story happened more than, 48 years ago, it's still alive to him today. And it was like a time machine. He took me back with him. And I was reliving the experience with him, and I was on the edge of my seat just listening to him.
And we are too, and we're going to hear about the morning after all of this incredible experience happened.
After I went to the top of the tree, I had a military belt, and I moved it out to the last hitch and put it around me and the tree. So in case I did get gassed, I wouldn't fall down. And then finally, these two humanoids stepped back from the tree, and another robot came. And there was two just about the same place that the two humanoids were. And they stood facing each other, and the flames, just like lightning, real, real bright, and just came between them. And then the gas was so thick coming up the tree that it would dissipate just about the time I got to me. But then that's when I'd start to gasp for air. And then when I woke up from that, it was light, but the sun hadn't come up yet. And I was just hanging by my belt, my head down, my feet down, and they were gone. Well, I knew I made it. I lived through the night.
Just to go back, did you fall asleep? Or this gas, did it overwhelm you?
Yeah, that's when it just... It completely engulfed the whole tree and got up to me, and I don't know how long I was out, but it was just you could see just a dim glow of the sun on the clouds and stuff, not clouds, but in the sky. And then when I woke up, it was light, but the sun hadn't come up yet. I got down and I found my compass and no coins. The coins were gone, and my canteen. But I knew which way I shot the arrow and which way it would arc. So I found two of them and then tried to make my way back to camp. And I got almost to camp, and I just kind of, fatigue and everything, I just laid down. And I heard this, my buddy, hunting buddy, whistling. And I yelled at him, and he come pick me up and help me to camp. I slept for about 6 hours because I'd been up all night. And then they didn't bug me until I woke up. Then I told them more of the story.
What was their reaction?
Well, they believed me because they saw the condition I was in.
So his hunting buddies absolutely believed what he had to say as well.
Yes, that's correct. And the other interesting thing is that one of his buddies, Mr. Alvarez, Vincent Alvarez, later testified that he saw the initial entry of the mothership out of the Earth's atmosphere when it came zooming down and assumed a position near where Mr. Shrum was. Now, of course, Mr. Alvarez did not see any of what happened to Mr. Shrum because he was quite a distance away from him. However, he did see, you know, as I mentioned, and later gave a written affidavit stating that he saw the arrival of the mothership.
And this is something that has had long-lasting effects, I assume. We're going to hear about it from this, the final clip, from Don Trump talking about his experience with aliens in the forest.
How has this affected you? Did you have any nightmares?
Well, for a year, I had, screaming nightmares. I mean, I'd wake up yelling, those eyes, and I'd be just a cold sweat, just be drenched with sweat.
So what happened with the Air Force?
Well, they made an appointment with two post-mission representatives of the Air Force, and they tried to disillusion me. They said, well, you know, the Japanese might have had somebody up there. You know, they were still... And they said there was Boy Scouts dressed up, you know, in costume just to scare somebody. And I said, yeah, I'm sure they're going to spend all night and keep a guy in a tree, you know. Oh, then they said the Army probably bivouacked up there and it was in a training camp. So my father-in-law was in the Air Force, So he called and found out there was no military in that area for any reason, because it was a pretty desolate area. And they tried to disillusion me in every way they could. And they took the arrowhead, the main one, and they said, well, we'll get back to you and you can have this back as soon as we get through with it, which I never did. But when I went back up there during rifle season, I found the other arrow, the third one. And when we went back, the area had been raked. There's an area probably 50 feet around that tree, and there was cigarette packages and cigar butts. And so I know the Air Force checked it out pretty good. And they had an easy way to find it, because there's an orange circle around that tree that where it caught little fires, and it was showing orange, so they had no problem finding it. And I marked on the map that they had where it was, the location.
So really, the government was absolutely no help, quite to the contrary. And he sounds like what he's describing there is post-traumatic stress disorder. And had a hard time after this.
Well, that's absolutely correct. He went through this post-traumatic issues, and he had also, there was a hypnotherapist that did assist him, and this was very important because one of the biggest fears that Don had was that he thought perhaps when he was unconscious that he might have been kidnapped or taken on board, but as it turned out, that it looked like they never did that. The fact that when he woke up, he was hanging on the tree, you know. And this is an interesting discussion. You know, both Noah and I had been talking about this, because here's a man that used primitive weapons, fire, his bow and arrow, just things that were available to him to fight these guys. And had he had a rifle, maybe the events might have turned around.
One of the things that intrigued me was the fact that Don did not want to harm the two humanoids. There was some sort of feeling that he had that had he injured them in any way, that there probably would have been severe consequences. So that, and not only that, it was actually the robot that was causing him harm with the vapor that was being emitted from the robot's mouth. And so Don did whatever he could to survive, and he used his wits and his hunting wits, which got him through.
So he really believed they meant to kill him.
I think it was more a case of he felt that they either wanted him as some sort of specimen that they were coming to collect, or that, you know, that they were going to carry. He definitely felt they were going to carry him away and he would never see his family again. That was a strong feeling deep inside him.
His strong sense of survival was he wanted to be with his family, his wife and his new child, his daughter, and that's what kept him alive.
And the thing that gets me about this story is just to have that firsthand testimony from somebody who, you know, at the time of testimony is not in any way impaired in terms of being extremely elderly, or, you know, he's fully within his faculties, even though this happened, you know, almost 50 years ago. He's still fully in his faculties, concise, still very descriptive. And that's what I love about, because when you talk to people from things that happened years and years ago, sometimes you don't have the benefit of that, do you?
Here's the other interesting thing, Jim, is I took the verbal testimony that he gave right after the encounter. He gave to NICAP, to Paul Cerny. I took that testimony, which was taped, and Ruben sent me copies of the original Paul Cerny tapes. I took that and I transcribed that out word for word on notepads. And then I took the testimony that he gave Ruben just a few years ago, the one we've been listening to, and also transcribed it word for word, compared the two, and none of his answers had varied to any degree. It was almost word for word what he told the NICAP investigators in the months following the encounter in 1964. So that was amazing to me.
Yeah, and that also, to me, says, he's telling the truth.
Yes. The other thing that is unique in the sense that as Don's describing the tree and that, and I had the opportunity to travel to Cisco Grove, which is about going toward Truckee, toward Reno on Highway 80. And back then it was the Interstate 40. And with Noe's assistance, we were able to track down the location. Actually, I was about 2 miles from the actual site. But what intrigued us was the fact that it was very dense wooded pine trees, a lot of granite rock formations. It's just very rugged. So, I mean, you're out in no man's land once you leave the highway, the main highway, and you start hiking. So our intent is to actually find the actual ground zero, as we would say, and hopefully we'll find that tree if it still exists. But who knows if these entities may have kidnapped or abduct other hunters, other people out there in the woods, because of how many people wind up missing over a period of time. So this kind of adds to the whole mystery.
So how has it ended up for Mr. Shrum? Has he come to terms with it? Do you think maybe telling this story in full has kind of closed the circle for him where he can cope with this?
Well, we have gotten some very positive comments from his son, Dan Shrum. In fact, Dan was on a radio show with us not too long ago in which he talked about how this has so deeply affected both his dad and his mom, who recently passed away. But Dan assures us that the release of the book gave a great sense of closure and a gratifying sense of having put this behind them, both to his dad and his mom before she passed away. And so Ruben and I were very happy to have been a small part of that. They wanted their story told in its entirety for the first time ever. And Ruben, the book that Ruben and I wrote, of course, was the first time that they had authorized the telling of the story in its entirety. So, you know, we were thrilled to have perhaps had a small role in giving them that sense of closure.
One thing that she said to us before she had passed away, she says that she would really like to see this story turn into a movie. So we're hoping that maybe that might be the next step to really get the story out, if someone would want to take that on as a movie production. So we're keeping our fingers crossed that will happen.
Well, it sounds like a great movie. It is certainly a great sighting. We're so appreciative that you took time to tell us about aliens in the forest, the Cisco Grove UFO encounter. Fascinating testimony. Thank you very much for sharing that with us, because that's not something you had to do. We appreciate you allowing us to release those clips on the podcast. I do want to ask, and I want to find out where we can get the book and so forth, but what other projects are you working on that you can tell us a little bit about, just so folks can know all of the things you guys are up to, because I know you're extremely active with a lot of irons in the proverbial fire.
Well, we just finished up the Roswell UFO Festival. We actually organized the lecture series this year, and we had an outstanding turnout during a 4-day conference. We saw over 1,000 people attend. We had a fantastic time in Roswell, New Mexico. And already planning ahead to next year's conference as well, 2013. Of course, that's assuming that we make it past November of this year. But anyway, Ruben and I will be are also participating in a fantastic new event, which is the first annual Border Zone International UFO Festival that's going to be held along the Texas-Mexico border in the small town of Presidio, Texas. It's really, though, a kind of a regional event involving the whole Big Bend area. And that event is October 19th and 20th of this, you know, this year. And all of this information about how to order our book and our upcoming involvement in various events can be found at our website, roswellbooks.com. So that's the easiest place to find that, roswellbooks.com.
Well, again, gentlemen, it's been an absolute pleasure. It was a fascinating retelling of this story. The audio testimony was very compelling, as was your description of it. Thank you so much for taking time to be on the Paranormal Podcast today.
Thank you for having us on today.
Yes, thank you very much, Jim.
And thank you for tuning in. We appreciate it, and we hope that you enjoyed the program. We know that we did. And hopefully, we'll hear back from you next week. We'll talk to you then. Everyone, have a great one. Bye-bye.
Now for the legal disclaimer. We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold and JimHarold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although we really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to JimHarold.com, and thanks for listening.